Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to July 4th weekend of Philly Fanatics, Philly Sports Talk. And I am Eric Fisher. With me, Gordon Glantz, Josh Landsberg. It is free agent week. Although, here in Philadelphia, despite all the excitement around the country, free agency has been a little underwhelming. And maybe to be expected with the Flyers, they didn't have a lot of cap room. But the Sixers, I think some people thought they'd make more of a splash. I'm not one of them, but they signed Jared Bayless. At least they agreed to terms. Officially signings can't be announced until Thursday. But as a point guard, the Sixers will be his seventh team in 9 years. He is probably an upgrade on what they had before. They signed him to a three-year, $27 million contract, which sounds insane unless you look at the other contracts going around. For example, former Sixer Evan Turner apparently was offered $70 million for 4 years by the Trailblazers. So the money's crazy in the NBA. But let's look at let's go to, and Josh, actually we'll start with you, Josh. Why do you think the Sixers weren't able to attract more players? I mean, this is what they've been waiting for, this free agency, and they have all this money available. Why couldn't they get better players than Jared Bayless?
Well, first I just wanted to touch on what you're talking about, Evan Turner, and some of these guys around the league. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Some of the mediocre talent around the NBA that's getting max contracts, getting unbelievable deals, millions upon millions of dollars, and just really not worth it. So you look at it that way, the Sixers actually got a bargain with Bayless for the 3 years, $27 million and $9 million a clip a year. He's not, you know, as you said, it's his seventh team in just nine seasons, but he's a pretty good college player, and he's, I think, an upgrade over Ish Smith. I think he's going to be a decent point guard for them. I think he's a bit of an upgrade. I didn't like them not re-signing Ish Smith because I thought he could be a good backup, and he was probably one of the best players for this bad Sixers team last year. So I didn't like them not bringing him back, but I think Bayless isn't such a bad guy to bring in. I think the Sixers are looking at next year with guys like Kyle Korver and J.J. Redick being free agents. They could come in as shooters and help this team out. And I think that it's hard to attract the big-time free agents to Philadelphia for a couple reasons, Eric. And one of them, which a lot of people don't talk about too much, is the Philadelphia wage tax. I mean, Philadelphia has one of the highest wage taxes in the country, and a lot of players are greedy, and they want that money, but they want that money to really count. So the Sixers have to overpay for guys in places like Miami or Texas or places like that where they have little to no wage tax. Guys are going to go there for more money. So that's something to consider. Also, the fact that the Sixers are so young. They're unproven. They won only 10 games last year, one shy of the all-time record, which they set in the 72-73 season at 9 wins. And they're just unproven. They're young. They do have a lot of talent. They did bring in Ben Simmons, which I'm sure we'll get to a little bit later in the show. And they do have Joel Embiid, who was considered, if he didn't have the injuries, probably the number one overall pick a couple years ago when he came out of the draft. The Sixers ended up getting him at 3, I believe. This team is just very unproven, and they do have a lot of young talent, but that's the problem. They're all young. They have no veterans on this team, really. And I think that a veteran free agent wants to go to a team where he has a better chance to win a championship, not in 3 or 4 years, but this upcoming year, this year, the following year. So guys like Kevin Durant aren't going to come to Philadelphia, and guys of that ilk, guys who are top-tier free agents, aren't going to come to Philadelphia. A guy like Bradley Beal, I would have liked to see the Sixers go after, but he's just for those reasons, I think he wasn't one of those guys that would come to Philadelphia. So I'm not surprised that they weren't able to attract the top tier free agents.
Yeah, with the money going, the salary cap going up to it, it's projected to be about $94 million. It's going to be about $20 million or so. Everybody has money, and as Josh just pointed out, guys, they were able to re-sign their free agents like Bradley Beal with the Wizards, and not. Not run into a cap crunch in terms of getting other players. I don't want to turn this into a tax seminar, Josh, but it was a really good point you made about the wage tax. It has not been talked about at all, but I will tell you that one of the reasons the Sixers are building their new practice facility in Camden along the waterfront rather than in Philadelphia is they will cite that as their home base. And, again, I don't want to turn it into a tax seminar, but the way tax law is written in previous cases – the players then will only pay wage tax on game day when they play at Wells Fargo Center. Otherwise, their place of employment will actually be in Camden, and they will not pay that wage tax. So the Sixers can fix that next year when that practice center opens. Gordon, now that we've dispensed with the tax law section of the program, unless you're a Titan, unless you want to weigh in on that. Do you want to weigh in on the Titans?
No, I'm starting to nod off, actually.
So what does this mean for the Sixers? And I'll tell you, I watched our colleague and friend Mike Silski last week, and he was worried that actually they were going to spend a lot of money for mediocre NBA free agents, and they were going to become a mediocre team in that NBA purgatory, exactly what they've been saying they were trying to avoid. He's probably happy. What do you think of that? Are the Sixers better off actually not signing, mediocre, as Josh said, an Evan Turner for that type of player for $60, $70 million contract? Are they better off just going with the young guys and going through more of the growing pains, even if it means fewer wins next year?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there should be a happy medium in between. You certainly don't want to handcuff yourself with guys with bad contracts. I mean, we've seen how it works where you just want to have these salary hefty trades around the league at the trading deadline, which are salary dumps, because of bad contracts that teams just, have buyer's remorse. But, at the time seems like a good idea because you have to outbid other people for players and an average guy's, the extra value gets attached to it. And you don't want to get stuck in that purgatory. I think where the Sixers would be better served to use their cap space that they have, and what we may see, whether it's now before the season or maybe at the trade deadline, is them, make a trade that they've made no bones about the fact that they're going to look to move one of their big men and acquire somebody else. And maybe that somebody else they acquire is somebody, who's maybe more in the prime of their career, who does make a nice chunk of change, and whom they would have to maybe it's a guy who's coming to the end of their contract and they would have to, spend a lot of money to keep here. And that would have to be part of that they work out with that person's agent even before the trigger's pulled on a trade. But maybe you'll see that big money guy come here via trade as opposed to overpaying in the free agent market. Now, that would be something I would definitely get behind. That may be the happy medium that I'm talking about, not overpaying for the Evan Turners of the world. I can see what Mike Solsky's saying, and it makes a lot of sense. You don't want to kind of go back to what you're trying to get away from, in terms of the process. So, I hate to use the word patience, but I guess a little bit more patience is going to need to be used. The Sixers should be better just by who they added in the draft. They should be better just with guys getting older and who they added in the draft. They should get better, and if they get better, they should attract people next year, as Josh alluded to. There's going to be guys on the market. The draft is going to be guard-heavy next year. So you don't want to lock into a guard now when you could end up with a guard or two next year in the draft. So I think they did the prudent thing. It's not easy always to do the prudent thing when a lot of guys are on the market and the money's flying around. But, I think they did the prudent thing, and I don't think they're done yet. I think that a trade or two trades could be coming, and you could see, somebody of more value than an Evan Turner type come here at a number that that it's worth the salary that they'll be getting.
Good points, Gordon. Josh, let's build off what Gordon talked about trades. And we know the Sixers tried to trade Nerlens Noel and Jahlil Okafor. I don't think there's a secret there. Did they overvalue those guys? I mean, Okafor was the third pick in the draft last year, and Noel was the sixth pick in the draft, and they got him in that trade. And my question is, did the Sixers overvalue those players? They can't get back. Apparently, they can't get back a third round, a number three pick from Boston for them. Did they overvalue those guys?
I don't know if they overvalued them or not. To be honest, I wanted to talk about that move. You guys, when I talked about it last week on the show, the draft day move that was rumored to happen that Boston turned down. I think Danny Ainge in Boston was ludicrous for turning that deal down. They got the king's ransom, as you would say, I think, in that deal, and they were going to give up the number three pick. Yes, they must have really liked Chris Dunn a lot, but for what the Sixers were giving up and what Boston was getting, I think the Sixers were just giving up too much, and I think sometimes the best trades are the ones you don't make. I think that was actually good that Boston didn't accept that, because I think the Sixers I would prefer them to trade Okafor rather than Noel. I think Noel is a great defensive player, and A lot of teams are built around defense. That Sixers team that went to the 2001 NBA Finals had a great star in Allen Iverson, but they were a great defensive team. And, yes, they didn't win the championship, but they were built around defense. And a lot of great teams have great defenses. And a guy like Nerlens Noel could kind of be like a Theo Ratliff type of player. He doesn't have much offensive game, but he's able to be that rim protector, be able to be that off-the-ball guy who can block shots and rebounds. And Okafor is more of an offensive player who has the potential to be a 20-10 guy, which you don't see too often. But at the same time, if Embiid is the real deal and he's healthy, then you don't have use for Okafor. So I'd rather see them trade Okafor than Noel. And I think that the Sixers were lucky that Boston didn't accept that trade. But I think that Okafor and Noel do have a lot of value. Maybe the Sixers are overvaluing them a little bit, and the rest of the league doesn't see their ceiling quite as high as the Sixers do. But I still think that, you know, maybe it's one of those things where the Sixers kind of have come right out and told everyone they're going to trade one of their big men. So it's one of those situations where the rest of the league doesn't quite have to give up as much, you know, in that situation, because they know the Sixers are going to make a move. When, you know, a team's kind of desperate to make a move, the other teams can kind of smell that blood, and they're not going to give up as much. But I think Boston was willing to give up a whole lot to get Noel.
All right, wait a minute. Listen.
Thank you. We have a caller on the line. Caller, you have a question? Caller, last number is 4448. Do you have a question? No, I'll come back to you in a little bit. We have another on the line. Gordon, before I come to you, caller, last four numbers, 1789. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to just ask about the philosophy Josh was talking about. Sometimes the best trades are the ones you don't make, and they just get lucky that Boston turned them down.
Go ahead. What's your comment or question?
Did the Sixers get lucky that Boston turned them down for a trade that was so one-sided they get to keep who they had?
You know, I've read that both ways. And, Josh, let me just make sure. Josh, you're talking about the trade. It was the 3, the 24, the 26, and Robert Covington. Is that what the trade you're talking about?
Yeah, Robert Covington.
Yeah,
Robert Covington and Nerlens Noel.
With all those guys. Yeah, I think that – All of that is too much. I agree.
My question for Josh is, does he think Okafor is undervalued?
Do you think Okafor is undervalued by the Sixers or by the league, do you mean?
Right. Either one.
Either one. Josh, do you think Jahlil Okafor is undervalued?
No, I don't think so, because I think he is what he is. I mean, he could still improve to be a better player, but I think the Sixers just see him as not a factor on the defensive side of the ball, and Brett Brown is a guy who wants to preach defense. He comes from the Greg Popovich line of coaching, and Popovich has always had great defensive teams, so I think that he just doesn't fit what the Sixers team wants to do, and he might be valued by another team, actually. I think he could be more valued by the rest of the league, possibly, and maybe in the Sixer system.
Can I comment on that?
My thinking
is that the offense is talent-laden and defense is want-to, coachable-laden. So what I mean by that is that if you're a defensive player, that's more about wanting to be a defensive player. Like Iguodala wants that more than anything. He's got limited offensive skills, but he's made himself into an all-star. Okafor, I think, is a power center, of which there are few in the league, with a unique skill set offensively that can't really be taught, but his defense is what can be taught in the right system. I think he's going to thrive. The Sixers should just keep him.
Yeah, although I guess the question there is, the Sixers certainly need people who can score. I mean, that's one problem they've had.
Exactly.
You know, if you give up on a guy that fast. Go ahead. You can answer, but do you give up on him after 1 year, or do you hope he becomes a better defensive player?
Exactly right. I don't want to give up on him.
You don't want to give up. Okay. Good question. Thank you.
All right,
thank you for the call and comment. Hey, Gordon. Thank you. Gordon, rookie camp starts tomorrow. Summer league camp, I should say, starts tomorrow. The Sixers play the Celtics in Utah. What do you want to see from Ben Simmons this week in the 3 games? What do you want to see out of him?
You know, I want. You know, I don't want to see him press. I want to see him just play his game. It's going to be tough for him. You know, it's more. These are more like glorified pickup games, because you have maybe one or two practices with a bunch of guys that you don't really know, and you're kind of out there and you're in a weird situation where you're trying to play as a team, win the game, but you're trying to showcase your skills at the same time. But he doesn't have that same pressure that some of these other guys are. So it's going to be a weird situation. I mean, does he try to score more and not you know, pass the way we've seen him pass the college level? You know, so I just want to see him play his game, play an all-around game, have a good floor game. I'd like to see maybe the shot be a little bit better than what we're told his shot is. You know, we're told that's a weak part of his game, and I would hope that since his season ended at LSU, he's been working on that a little bit. Maybe we'll see that a little bit in the summer league. So I guess I'd like to see him drop some shots to take a little pressure off himself and just kind of, you know, play a good floor game, you know, see some assists, see some rebounds. I guess the important thing, I mean, you're looking at a guy who's a top player in the draft and he's playing in a rookie league. I know there's some second, third year guys that are probably playing as well, some, journeyman type guys, but he should really be the best player on the floor. But he doesn't have to, if he puts that kind of pressure on himself and tries to, be overly aggressive, it won't work out that way. But, you know, I like to see him naturally just be the best player on the floor, for stretches of games. I know he won't play a ton of minutes, but I guess that's kind of in a nutshell what I'd like to see.
Okay. Josh, what do you want to see from Ben Simmons in the three games this week?
I'd like to see him, do what he does best. I'd like to, see him kind of do a little bit of everything. I'd like to see him be able to score the ball, be able to pass the ball, and be able to rebound the ball, and be able to defend. He's not a guy who's going to hit a lot of outside shots. That's just not his game. But he, he's 6'10". He's a big body in there, and he can play down low. He can handle the ball up top at the, as a big point guard, kind of like a Magic Johnson type. He can do a little bit of everything. So I'd like to see him really show his skill set and really show what he can do, early on in his career. You know, there's not much you can really always take from the summer camp or the summer league, but I'd like to see him get other guys involved. And, Gordon was talking about, is he going to want to do that? Is he going to just want to score the ball? I think he's going to try to play his game. There was rumors coming out of LSU, actually, just to touch on that a little bit, that the reason why he didn't go to the tournament part of the reason why he kind of had a tougher second half of the season than the first half is that guys on his team were jealous of him and didn't want to pass him the ball and didn't want him to score. So I don't think you'll see that type of same thing happen in the summer league or in his NBA career with the Sixers. I think that, that's kind of more immaturity you see at the college level, and I think that you're going to see him do a little bit of everything in the summer league and going forward in his career.
Yep. It'll be interesting to see what he does. Again, you can't tell too much from the summer league. He's playing against other rookies and free agents and stuff. But, of course, everyone's anticipating to see what he will do. Gordon's talking about a shot. We'll see how he plays. I will say that Jared Bayless signing, although we didn't get into this, he's not really a pure point guard. He's sort of a combination guard, and he's a really good outside shooter. I think that may be an indication that we're going to see Ben Simmons with, if he's not going to play, the true point forward, he's at least going to have the ball in his hands a lot with Bayless, rather than handling the ball, Bayless getting out on the wing and, having Simmons kick it out to him for three-pointers. All right, let's shift to the Flyers. We knew they weren't going to do very much, Gordon, because they didn't have a lot of money under the cap. Are you okay with what they did with Dale Weiss and Boyd Gordon?
That's almost a little too much because I would have been fine if they just re-signed Peter White, to be honest with you. But, Weiss,
Brian White. That was Clark's son-in-law.
What's
right?
that? Yeah,
Brian
right,
White.
Right.
Peter
but,
White
you know,
was Clark's son-in-law, right?
Right, right. I liked him. I thought he was the kind of typical fourth line kind of guy with the crooked nose and the missing teeth and could play up on a top line or a power play if needed to and pop in a goal once in a while and, drop the gloves, stick up for a teammate, Weiss is a little bit of a skill-wise, a little bit more of an upgrade. Boyd Gordon, I guess he's a guy you could send down to the Phantoms if you need to, or he can be your 13th, 14th forward. So I guess there's no harm there, quote unquote, good locker room guy. But I was hoping a spot would open up. I know we talk a lot about the defense. I was hoping a spot would open up, and I guess a spot is still there theoretically for Konechny or an Oscar Lindblom or, even a Nicholas Aubé-Kubel, one of those younger guys. or maybe a Taylor Lee or one of those guys have been, you know, in the system, you know, to maybe take a young guy kind of break into the lineup, you know, you know, I don't want these guys just playing forever in the minor leagues and you know, under the pretense, well, they're not going to get a lot of ice time. You know, in some cases, I'd rather see guys, you know, kind of break into the lineup, you know, on one of their lines now. And, you know, I like at least that competition with a young guy, you know, pushing somebody in training camp. And, you know, so signing two kind of run-of-the-mill forwards, especially, you know, Boyd Gordon's just really sort of just a guy. You know, we could probably help them. I just kind of felt like, you know, it may be one guy too many if you're going to try to break a young guy into the lineup. So, you know, maybe they could have just spent a little more money and gotten somebody a little bit more, you know, who can really help you more scoring-wise instead of getting two guys for the price of one, and that still would open up a spot, roster spot for, you know, a younger guy. So, you know, it is what it is. It's not, they're not harmful signings at all. You know, like I said, I like White, but, you know, whether it's just a straight trade-off or, you know, a slight improvement, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
You know, Dale, we've had 14 goals before he was traded, and then he didn't have any after he was traded to the Blackhawks. But, excuse me, when Montreal made their playoff run a couple years ago, he had a lot of big goals. I remember that. He's, you know, he's 27 years old. Seems to be the right thing. Boyd Gordon, I think, is a fourth-line defensive center who's going to give you no offense. And, you know, he could be down in the Phantoms, like you said. Now, the guy I wish they would have taken a shot at, and because he didn't end up costing very much, is Michael Grabner, who was with the Leafs last year. Only had 9 goals, but this is a guy who scored, you know, 30 goals as a rookie with the Islanders, and I think he had 24 the year after that. And he ended up only costing, I think it was $3.2 million for 2 years, so $1.6 million. I would like to see them, if that's all he costs, give him a shot, because he's capable of doing more. And, you know, I think Weiss is a third line guy. Gordon, I agree with you. I think Konechny, I'd like to see him on there. I think they're going to be looking still to trade people, and I think Matt Reed's going to be one of them because he's not a guy you'd protect in that expansion draft anyway next year. So we'll see what happens, although that might make him harder to trade. Josh, you were not on the show last week, so you'll get a chance to talk about this. We discussed it in advance last week about Eric Lindros' chance of making the Hall of Fame. And on Monday, it did come out that he made the Hall of Fame, that he's going to be inducted in November. What is your opinion on Eric Lindros going into the Hockey Hall of Fame?
I'm kind of torn on this one, Eric, actually. I'm curious what you guys thought as well. I was a little bit surprised when I first heard it. I thought he probably was deserving of it, but he was one of those guys that was a great talent, and he had a pretty great career overall. He, of course, never won the Cup with the Flyers. He did get there in 1997, albeit to get swept by a great Detroit Red Wings team. But he had a lot of good years here in Philadelphia. They went to the playoffs pretty much every year he was here, it seemed like. And he was the leader of that Legion of Doom with John McClure on there and Michael Remberg, and that was a great line the Flyers had. But he had some injuries later on in his career and didn't have quite as long a career as maybe some of the other guys that are in the Hall of Fame did. But he was a great talent. Of course, you know, it's easy to play Monday morning quarterback, but in the trade that they made for him, you would have rather had a guy like Peter Forsberg as opposed to Eric Lindros, who actually did end up getting Peter Forsberg later on in his career. But I believe it was actually Forsberg and if you correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, but I believe Flyers traded Forsberg and Sakic in that deal to get Lindros, or
no.
Draft pick, who ended up?
No. Forsberg was the draft pick. Yeah, Sakic's not in there.
Forsberg was the draft pick. Okay, so they had Lindros instead. But Lindros, I think, was deserving of the Hall of Fame. But at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if he didn't make it in as well.
So okay, so Gordon, you and I were in agreement last week, right, that he deserved to be in, correct?
Considering what the you know, this year's class kind of looked like, it was a good, if he was ever going to get in, there weren't a lot of slam dunks. I think that I kind of predicated with that a little bit. That if there's, you know, looking at who he was up against this year, it seemed like a good year for him to get in. You know, I was kind of surprised to talk about Mark Recchi. He still didn't get in. So, you know, that was kind of a tough – that's a guy that kind of had a long career and was productive for a long period of time. And we're talking about Lindros, who had a shorter career and was extremely productive for a shorter period of time, who did get in. But, you know, I have no real qualms with Lindros. I maybe if you asked me 5 years ago, I would have had more issue with it. But when you're the most dominant player in the game for any stretch of time, even if it's only for a few years, you know, I think it has to be taken into consideration. So, yeah, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of my – it's interesting that Recchi was up again at the same time and also did not get in, because that's sort of the comparison. You have a guy, and when you talk about Hall of Fame, you have a guy like Recchi, productive, you know, 20-some-year career. You know, what he's, I think he's 12th in the NHL in career points, which is, so he'll get in eventually, I think. Three Stanley Cups, and you know, he was a – he wasn't the star of any of those teams, but he was a, you know, a solid contributor on all of those teams. And yet he was never the best player on his team. You got a guy like Lindros, who was not just the best player on his team, but was the best player in the league, I think, for a shorter period, or certainly was among the very best players in the league for almost, I'll say, his entire Flyers career, right up to the last year, where concussions really took him down. Just for numbers' sake, and you know, I think Lindros transcends the numbers. You just have to watch him play to see the impact he made on games. But he ranks 19th in NHL history. In points per game at 1.14. And, Gordon, we talked about last week, you know, that's during a – or maybe we didn't talk about it, I can't remember now. You know, that was during an era when there weren't a lot of goals being scored, with the Devils being such a – you know, the Devils' style and the trap and the clutch and grab being so dominant during the 90s. And you could do anything to Lindros pretty much and not get a penalty.
Yeah.
He's 19th overall.
Like he was, yeah, it seemed like he was always playing in a phone booth a lot of times.
Yeah. And if you look at just his Flyers years, if you want to see how dominant he was, he averaged even in that era, he averaged 1.36 points per game, which would rank him fifth on all time behind Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, Mike Bossy, and Bobby Orr. So I think he's very deserving. I actually think it was overdue. So I'm glad he's in. We're going to run out of time here and go into archive. But, Josh, let me give you a quick shot to get us into this topic before the break, to just about, say, a minute and a half, 2 minutes here. Buddy Ryan died on Tuesday morning. Best known around here for being the Eagles coach, probably best known nationally for being the Bears defensive coordinator. What do you think Buddy Ryan's legacy is? What does he leave us with?
Yeah, very, very sad news happening this past week. I think his legacy is that he was a hard-nosed coach. He didn't take anything from anybody. He was going to go after any of his opponents. I think one thing that I always remember is I think he was quoted as saying, "We could go 2-14 as long as those 2 wins are against Dallas." So he really hated the Cowboys, and I think the city really embraced that, how much he hated the Cowboys, our biggest rival, and you know, really taking that on and having a great defense here. The Eagles were, I don't think the only one, but one of the only ones ever to rank number one in every category in that 1990 season, where they were number one against the run, number one against the pass, and number one overall, and I think number one points allowed also. So they were tops in every category, and that's really rare in football to be able to do that. And unfortunately, that was the same season, 1990, that Randall got hurt when they did that. And if Randall was healthy, who knows, maybe they win a Super Bowl or at least get farther in the playoffs than they had in other seasons that Buddy was here. So it was, and they still went 10-6 even with Randall hurt. So he'll be remembered as a very fiery coach, a guy who had a lot of personality, a guy who went after Dallas and went after his opponents, and just a great overall defensive coach. But I think he'll be remembered a little bit for, you know, I think he was one of the most beloved figures in Philadelphia sports history. He'll be remembered a little bit for shortcomings for never bringing that Super Bowl to Philadelphia. But overall, I think it's kind of like Allen Iverson. Even though he didn't win it, there's just a love fest with Buddy Ryan, just like Allen Iverson.
Yeah, hey, Gordon, you'll be able to help me with this. I think the year they were number one across the board and Randall got hurt, was that with Buddy or was that the next year with Bud Carson as the defensive coordinator? Do you remember that?
That was Rich Kotite's first year and the first year with Bud Carson as defensive coordinator, which would lead me to what I would want to say about Buddy Ryan, which I guess we could say on the other side.
just hang on for a minute. Yeah. So, Josh, it was Buddy's players, though. It was the guys he brought in, but actually that year was Kotite's first year with Bud Carson as the coordinator, but it doesn't take away that all those guys were brought in, pretty most of them, I should say, were brought in with Buddy Ryan. For those listening live, thank you. I want to thank our callers, although one of them hung up before she got her question in, but I believe Bill was the other caller. Thank you for your questions. Check out PhillyFanatics.com. Lots of great stuff on free agency. More stuff coming up. We got columns, all sorts of stuff. So check out PhillyFanatics.com, and we will talk to you next week live. Those of you listening in archive, we're going to just continue the show here. Gordon, go ahead on Buddy Ryan and his legacy and whatever you were about to say there.
Yeah, well, I guess I have a little bit of a different take on Buddy Ryan. You know, they say don't speak ill of the dead. So, and it's not really speaking ill of the dead. I have nothing against him personally. I only had one personal time I met him where as a reporter, and he was very pleasant. It was a one-on-one exchange, and he was very nice. So I have nothing against him personally. But you know, I think he gets a lot more credit than he deserves in a lot of areas, so I don't think it's speaking ill of the dead. I just want to speak accurately of a person who happens to have just died. You know, it was when he came here in real time, he brought a lot of excitement. Football had gotten pretty moribund in Philadelphia. You know, the Dick Vermeil era kind of ended kind of really abruptly. You know, they made the playoffs the 1 year after the Super Bowl, and then the year after that was a strike season, and then he stepped down, and then Marion Campbell came in, and the teams were not only not winning, they were pretty boring, and Buddy Ryan kind of came in with a different kind of attitude, and it gave the Eagles a different kind of attitude, and it gave the fans, I noticed just going to the games as a season ticket guy, a different kind of attitude, and you felt that, you know, you felt even if they were going to lose, they were going to play hard, and they weren't going to take anything from the opponent. And I think once you step on a field believing you can win, you start to win. And I think that happened a lot, and it definitely changed the outlook. And I think you were kind of proud in real time of being an Eagles fan and waking up every Sunday during football season and feeling like you could win the game, which you didn't have for a while. And there was not a long while. I mean, Mary Campbell wasn't the coach a long time, but it felt like a long time. But really just those three playoff losses where they were really ill prepared in those games. And he was head coach, I felt, and, you know, he gets a lot of credit. I mean, for things he didn't really do. Randall Cunningham was here before he got here. Reggie White was here before he got here. Andre Woodruff was here before he got here. You know, he helped these guys develop, and we'll give him credit for that, for letting Randall Cunningham go out there and play and just, you know, do his thing. But, you know, I think his ego got in the way a little bit there. He should have had an offensive coordinator that was maybe a silent co-coach who really just ran the offense. I mean, I know it's taking it's just kind of a fantastical scenario. But can you imagine, like, Randall Cunningham and some of the personnel they had now running, like, Chip Kelly's offense? How good Randall Cunningham with the Keith Jacksons and Keith Byers and some of those guys would have been in that offense? You know, somebody who really had an innovative offense, but I really felt like Buddy Ryan had some ego issues, and he didn't really want to be upstaged by an offensive coordinator, and I think that hurt him in the end. He didn't draft offensive linemen. Their offensive line really struggled, and you know, it kind of created a lot of it was a lot of the reasons why they didn't win playoff games. So
yeah,
you know, you have to, in retrospect, you have to look back and say he was a little bit of a disappointment. In reality, Rich Kotite, and I don't say Rich Kotite was a good coach. He had one fatal flaw that season we were talking about. He signed Pat Ryan instead of David Archer, or you know, and later he signed Jeff Kent later in the season. You know, they probably would have won one more game. And if they won one more game, they would have made the playoffs with that defense that finished first against the run and the pass, and possibly in points allowed, I don't remember. And then they would have, you know, been a dangerous team in the playoffs. And then we would have looked at Rich Kotite a lot differently. And Rich Kotite didn't win a playoff game. And Buddy, which is one more than Buddy Ryan won. So, you know, I also think, you know, as a season ticket holder, he brought a different caliber of fan to the stadium, who weren't as knowledgeable, who were a little more bloodthirsty, who were there to get drunk. I don't want to hang it all on Buddy Ryan, but, you know, it was a different stadium in the Ryan years than it was in the Vermeil years. And I'll just leave it at that. So like I said, I don't want to speak ill of the dead. I don't want to hang all that on him. Every fight in the stands, I want to hang that on Buddy Ryan. But You know, we have a presidential candidate who's running right now who's, I don't want to get into politics, who's, you know, fostering a certain kind of mentality out there, and I think he might have helped foster a certain mentality in his fan.
Okay, well, yeah, let's stop. We don't need the Donald Trump Buddy Ryan comparison right now. But, yeah, you know, Buddy, I think he was a tremendous defensive coach. I mean, if you look, you know, it took him a long time to get his first head coaching job, which was with the Eagles. People forget he was a defensive coordinator, or he was a defensive assistant coach, at least. I can't remember now if he's a coordinator for the Jets team, the Joe Namath team that won that surprise Super Bowl victory. He was with the Vikings as a defensive coach. You know, of course, he was the coordinator for the Bears with the dominating defense when they won Super Bowl 20, went 15-1 in the regular season and won the Super Bowl, dominating the Patriots. I mean, and he continued to be a good defensive coach with the Eagles. I mean, he was really good at picking out talent who fit his system, and, you know, and even with guys who were here before Gordon, as you pointed out, you know, working them into his system, taking advantage of their talents. He just never did, as a head coach, wasn't a good guy with the offensive side. I mean, you mentioned that he let Randall run out in there and do what he wanted to do and run around, and I wish he wouldn't have done that. I wish he would have brought somebody in to maybe hone his skills a little bit and make him, you know, a great player in a set offense, not just a guy who could create. So, but Mixon, great defensive coach. Gordon, you're absolutely right about his change the tone of football in Philadelphia. I mean, he's, you know, it's during his tenure, whether he gets full credit for it or not, that's when football became number one in the city, and it has been for the last 30 years, I'd say. You know, and that was really a change when Buddy came here. So, sorry to see him go. He 85, lived a full life. But always sad when somebody dies. Josh, before we get to final thoughts, I want to give you a shot at one thing, one baseball question. Aaron Nola, they're going to is 0-4 in his last five starts. ERA over 10. He gave up five runs again yesterday in five innings. Although it's the first time in five starts he made it past the fourth inning, they're going to skip his turn Thursday. And this was my lead item in Philly's notebook. What's wrong with Aaron Nola is this the best thing for him to skip his turn going into the All-Star break and give him time to recoup maybe?
Yeah, I think I'll answer the second part of the question first. I think it's a great move for them to skip his term in the rotation, and that leads me to the answer to the first question, because I think it's got to be all mental right now. He obviously has all the tools, and he's been successful, really successful, to start his career with the Phillies. You have to remember this is only his first full season with the Phillies. He didn't play a full season last year. And, you know, it's really every player has to go through growing pains, and he's certainly going through his growing pains right now. But I don't think it's his mechanics or anything like that. I just think it's really mental right now. And I think skipping a start, having a break, going into the All-Star break, having kind of a long break to kind of just settle himself and realize that, you know, they're not in a pennant race. They're not they don't have a lot of pressure on them. It's a young team. They're building a product for the future and kind of get his stuff together and hopefully come back stronger after the All-Star break and perform better after the All-Star break, because he does have the talent. He's certainly shown that throughout his early career in Philadelphia. He's just going through a little bit of a mental slump right now, and it's you know, lasted for five starts, as you mentioned, but hopefully he's going to come out of it.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's not let these run too long. We don't have to keep them real short, but let's not let them run too long. Time for final thoughts. Gordon starts off.
Okay. Well, we were talking about, you know, Buddy Ryan passing away, and I just want to make it clear, I wasn't, I was just looking at him strictly as his legacy here. It was exciting at the time, but looking back, you know, I try to put it in some perspective, but it certainly didn't want to see him die or anything like that. But you know, there's people who pass away in sports that affect athletes' lives at all levels. And it's a second anniversary today of the passing of Danny Algeo. You may know him, Eric. He was the son of Jim Algeo, the longtime coach at Lansdowne Catholic. And Danny played at Lansdowne Catholic, and then he was the assistant coach for him for a while. That's how I got to know him pretty well. And then he moved on to Roman Catholic, and then he moved on to Cardinal O'Hara. And it was 2 years ago today, he just died suddenly of a heart attack. He's my age. So he would have been 51 years old. You know, he was just one of those guys that, you know, loved football, loved life, and was just you know, the kind of guy. I mean, I remember when he was an assistant at Lansdale Catholic, they lost a final, made it to the Final Four in the state, and they lost on a last-minute play, and they were crying after the game because they felt like that was the one chance for their father to win a state title, and they were a few seconds away, and it didn't happen. It turns out Jimmy Andre did win a state title a few years later, but, you know, they didn't know that then. And Danny Andre was, I mean, hysterically crying, but sought me out and shook my hand and thanked me for all the coverage for that season, which how often do you get that? A thank you at any time, let alone at that moment. You know, it's just that kind of thing. He's one of those guys, even when he coached at the other schools I didn't cover anymore, whether it was before the game or after the game, would always say hello, big smile on her face. He's one of those guys, once he was your friend, he was always your friend. I'm not going to say we knew each other extremely well, but he was just one of those guys that we're glad he could be out there coaching our kids, and the outpouring when he passed away, and all the players that he coached, how they felt. And it just makes you sad of all the players he will never get to coach because that's dying at a relatively young age. And, I just wanted to remember him on this day.
Thank you, Glenn. Very appropriate. And I'd be remiss, since we're mentioning people who passed away, if I didn't mention the great Pat Summitt, who also died this past, or maybe about a week ago, Tennessee coach, women's coach. Also had a great influence on people's lives, although coaches do at all levels, from the college, and like you pointed out, then to someone like Danny Algia, who had a great effect on numerous people's lives through his coaching. Josh, your final thought?
Well, Eric, ironically, you mentioned him early on in the show, Mike Silski. I wanted to talk about his article you wrote in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it's also on philly.com. Philly's full of prodigies, so how do they stack up? It was written last Sunday, so I got a chance to read it today, actually. And he wrote a really interesting article about the four prospects that the Flyers, the Sixers, the Eagles, and the Phillies have coming in, starting with last year's NHL draft. So Ivan Provorov being the first guy, the defenseman, the Flyers drafted seventh overall in the draft. And he talked about, of course, Carson Wentz going next with the Eagles at the number two pick. Ben Simmons going number one overall to the Sixers, and then Mickey for the Phillies going number one in the baseball draft. So he talked about these guys, and I have to say I agree with what he said. He talked about different categories. Really interesting article about the speed of ascension, the inherent impact. He breaks it down, the sheer popularity, and where these guys rank, and kind of putting all the tests of talent, putting all these things together, how do they rank, who's going to be the best, who's going to make the biggest impact on their sport. And he has Ben Simmons at number one, Carson Wentz number two, Ivan Provorov number three, and Mickey Moniak number four. So I have to agree with him on this for a couple reasons. I think Moniak, he's only 18 years old. He's going to take 4 or 5 years probably to even come up to play for the Phillies. And Ben Simmons, I think, is going to make an impact in his first year right away. Carson Wentz, if he's the real deal, he can make an impact, maybe not in his first year right away, because it looks like Sam Bradford is going to be the quarterback at least to start the season, maybe not for the whole season, but could have Carson Wentz on the bench for the entire first year of his career, so he won't make an impact right away. But Provorov could potentially make an impact right away. But I think overall, I agree with him. Simmons, number one, Carson Wentz, number two, Provorov, three, and Mickey Moniak, number four, in terms of how these guys, and it's very exciting time in Philadelphia with all these young players and these guys to see what they can do, and there's hope once again in Philadelphia sports.
Yes, and you can go to Voice of the Fanatics on PhillyFanatics.com and say which one you think is the best draft pick right there. I'm going to talk about somebody we haven't talked about today, who's going into the Hall of Fame, which is usually a big deal, but Pat Quinn going to the Hall of Fame overshadowed, of course, because Eric Lindros was the headliner going in, and even Mark Recchi not getting in seemed to overshadow Pat Quinn. And, of course, we had all the free agency and Buddy Ryan passing away and all sorts of stuff going on. Pat Quinn was a tough defenseman. Flyers hired him, his first job assistant coach. He was down with the Maine Mariners, which was their minor league team, came up coached the Flyers, replacing Bob McCammon, actually switching jobs with him. And was a great coach for the Flyers, led them back to the Stanley Cup Finals, had that memorable 35-game unbeaten streak that still stands as the longest unbeaten streak in North American sports, I believe. And Pat Quinn was a great coach, went on to do a lot of great things with a lot of different teams. Never did win that Stanley Cup, got there with the Canucks to the Finals again, became involved with the Hockey Hall of Fame, became involved with international sports. So Pat Quinn, overshadowed by a lot of stuff that happened this week. I'm going to take a minute here and thank Pat Quinn for being a great guy. He has passed away, but really a wonderful hockey guy, and from everybody who knew him, a wonderful guy as well. That's it for this week's show. Thank you, Gordon Glantz, Josh Landsberg, great job. Please check out PhillyFanatics.com. Thanks to our callers. I believe one was Bill, and we will talk to you next week here on PhillyFanatics.com. Have a great week, everybody.